Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. As the definitive resource on the architectural history of New York City, the Landmarks of New York, an illustrated record of the city's historic buildings, 6th edition, documents and illustrates the 1,352 individual landmarks and 135 historic districts that have been accorded landmark status by the New York City Landmarks Preservation Commission since its establishment in 1965. Arranged chronologically by date of construction, the book's entries offer a sequential overview of the city's architectural history and richness, presenting a broad range of styles and building types: colonial farmhouses, Gilded Age mansions, churches, schools, libraries, museums, and the great 20th century skyscrapers that are recognized throughout the world. In this lecture, recorded on March 1, 2017 at the National Gallery of Art, Barbara Lee Diamonstein-Spielvogel shares how so many of these structures have endured, in large measure, through the efforts of the New York City Landmarks Preservation Commission and hundreds of private sector preservation organizations, large and small. Since the commission was established, New York City has become the leader of the preservation movement in the United States, with more buildings and districts designated and protected than in any other city.
What we're going to do today is discuss the landmarks of New York, and I hope you don't see it as a narrow and chauvinistic view of New York City, but it will be of necessity, an abbreviated journey through New York City's rich architectural history. Most memorable places in the world are known for their natural beauty: cascading waterfalls, lush rainforests, towering mountains. But New York City is celebrated above all for its unnatural beauty: soaring panorama of sky, stone, steel, and glass that defines this vertical city. The grand architecture that inspires us and the surprising little known treasures that are hidden within this great metropolis. Structures which may have less majesty, but which nonetheless have cultural and historical significance. These are the monuments and spaces that we remember and return to in daylight and in dreams. Without sounding excessive, it is true that New York is the leader in historic preservation, not only because the number and variety of buildings that it has designated and maintained, but the force of the preservation movement there. I'm especially interested in it, in something that goes far beyond surface ornamentation. I think as a preservation activist, as one of the most successful, broad-based, and egalitarian citizen movements in history. All the while that people are striving mightily to preserve their built environment in New York, they're also, through the centuries, contended with the pressures of development. Last year, for example, the New York City Landmarks Preservation Law came under direct attack when the New York City Council passed legislation that created new deadlines for designation where previously there were none. This is 51 plus years later. The new law requires that the Commission's decisions on potential individual landmarks be made within 1 year and on historic districts within 2 years. This new legislation demonstrated vividly to every segment of the public that the preservation of our architectural heritage is not guaranteed by our government, nor our Constitution, though it is clearly in accord with much of our nation's fundamental vision of human rights, human dignity, and the quality of life. I believe that it's not coincidental that the preservation movement evolved side by side in these past 51 years, with the civil rights, human rights, women's rights, LGBTQ rights, and other progressive movements. During these past years, all of these forces, including preservation, share the philosophical view that our right to self-determination should be balanced by our responsibility to each other and to a common greater good. That responsibility includes the preservation of our shared and singular histories. There is a reason that we embrace our past and try to inform our future, why we honor our past and imagine our future. In 1965, the New York City Landmarks Law was signed by then Mayor Robert Wagner to protect historic landmarks and neighborhoods from hasty decisions to destroy or alter their character. The law established the creation of a permanent new Landmarks Preservation Commission, authorized to designate a building to be a landmark or a particular landmark site, or to designate an area as an historic district. The legal definition of a landmark stipulates that the building must be at least 30 years old, shows what a young country we are, and have historical or architectural merit. As of this February 2017, the month that ended yesterday, the commission has granted landmark status to more than 36,000 buildings and sites, including 1,397 individually designated landmarks and 141 historic districts and extensions that exist collectively in all of the five boroughs. Now, some people think that the preservation law, which was discussed for a long time by some really community-minded people, civic-minded citizens, before anything happened. And many people give credit to our former First Lady, Jackie Kennedy, who after she moved to New York, took a very active interest in landmarks. But the reality is, and some people credit the raising of Pennsylvania Station, an abominable act that galvanized the citizenry. I have a personal theory that for many years there was a great deal of conversation in learned and civic circles. And at the time, the original Metropolitan Opera House, a not very attractive building, but had the singular quality that it needed most, perfect acoustics on 38th Street, was raised. And many of the people who were on that board or who enjoyed the opera were close friends of then Mayor Wagner. And I think that they were so insistent that he finally listened. A very decent and civic-minded mayor, it helps. And that's when the law was finally passed. Preservationists have long argued for the intangible social benefits of protecting the past from the wrecker's ball. Cities, as the greatest communal works of humankind, provide the deepest assurance of continuity between past and present. This may be the city's most valuable cultural function. The critic Lewis Mumford once said, "In the city, time becomes visible. The older buildings of our cities give us the possibility of visualizing the past, for they are, in a true sense, time capsules." The oldest wooden structure in New York State is the Dutch colonial farmhouse of Peter Klassen Wyckoff, built before 1641 in Brooklyn, that still stands on land that was purchased from what was then known as the Canarsie Indians. And it is among the earliest colonial settlements in our country. From the same period, the early wood frame Anglo-Dutch bound house, 1661, in Queens. By the way, if Queens were taken alone, it would be the fourth largest city in the United States. And if Brooklyn was taken alone, it would be the third largest city in the United States. I commend you, come visit cool Brooklyn while it is still cool, because it's getting cooler and cooler and more expensive. In any case, the Bound House is the oldest surviving dwelling in the borough of Queens. Now, it's a very simple farmhouse. That's how it looked then. This is how it looks now, recently restored and renovated. But it really, its most greatest significance is not its architecture, but it is a monument to religious freedom. And I hope you'll let me tell you a little bit about John Bound. John Bound was a Quaker who emigrated to the colonies, among other things, because of the promise that he could practice his religion in freedom. The house shown here is an engraving, an 1822 engraving. So the then governor was Peter Stuyvesant, as you all remember, but you may not have known he was a Calvinist who considered Quakers an abominable sect and a heretical sect, and told John Bound that he could not practice his religion. His friends came together in the living room of this modest house to practice their faith. Bound defied Stuyvesant's ban to practice his religion and continued to invite fellow Quakers to continue to meet in his house. Well, Stuyvesant told Bound, if you continue to do this, there will be punishments exacted, and Bound continued to defy him. So what happened? He was banished to Holland. In the late 1640s, 50s, where he was tried and acquitted for the practice of his religion. I'm sure the Dutch East India Company, among other things, all those telephone calls you get to new settlements, they promised freedom of religion. And while most people would agree that a lawyer who represents himself as a fool for a client and a fool for a lawyer, he won his case. And what he did when he returned to Flushing, the part of Queens that some of you may know, which was then the gardening center of the United States, brought about by one of the Bound descendants, of which there are now thousands and thousands throughout the United States, many of them illustrious citizens. But what he really did was help establish our fundamental principles of freedom of conscience and religious liberty. What makes it significant is those ideas were later codified in the United States Bill of Rights and helped establish our principles. If you notice that the exterior of the house is fully restored, completed a year ago. The interior is now being carefully renovated. When finished, it will contain approximately 5,000 objects original to the Bound family. Two Bound sisters, two maiden ladies, lived there till 1947. And it was with all the passed down century after century furniture and objects that were then, a number of them dispersed, but they still have more than 5,000 of them, and it will reopen, I assume, by the end of the year, because there is a major anniversary that will be celebrated nationally about freedom of religion that emanated from this tiny house. When New York City developed from a small colonial outpost to a major trading port, the need for public architecture that express the dignity of the growing metropolis led to the construction of some of the most significant early American architecture in our nation. New York's third and still current, what you're looking at is where the mayor of New York offices are, City Hall, still occupied as City Hall, originally built from 1803 to 1812. It was the winning entry in an architectural contest for which the prize was $350. Besides being a marvelous building and quaint story, the building was designed by the first American-born architect, John Macomb Jr., and a leading French emigre, Joseph Mangin. Mangin was a protege of Alexander Hamilton. But the grandeur of the interior, if you can show us that, please, is the result of its spatial organization. It's dominated by a cylindrical dome, domed rotunda, and the refined and decorative detail reflects the American Georgian manner. A double cantilevered stairway unfolds and circles up to the landing at the second floor. It's surrounded by 10 Corinthian columns supporting the Great Dome. Most recently, an award-winning 7-year-long restoration of the building took place. And in those halls, there are many portraits of early mayors and civic leaders, some by distinguished artists. And there are public tours, if it interests you, to ever go there. One of the most significant monuments in New York, and perhaps one of the least visited, is Federal Hall. That's the site where George Washington, on April 30th, 1789, took the historic oath of office, installing him as the first president of the United States. The event, it was memorialized. Do you see the statue out there? Not yet. By the 1883 bronze statue by John Quincy Adams Ward, that's in front, there he is, in front of the current building. The original building was demolished in 1812, and Federal Hall was rebuilt as the nation's first custom house. It opened in 1842 and was designed by Ithiel Towne and Alexander Jackson Davis. It's one of the finest surviving examples of classic architecture in New York. The Doric columns of the facade resemble those of the Parthenon, and its interior domed ceiling, it really is magnificent. On December 2nd, 2015, Federal Hall was designated a national treasure by the National Trust, and at the same time, the American Express Foundation announced its donation of $300,000 to begin restoration of the building's facade. What is happening there now is an attempt to animate the building. For those of you who are frequent or infrequent visitors to New York, the theater scene on Broadway, off-Broadway, and off-off-Broadway is really booming, interesting, filled with nascent and established talents, and worth a visit on its own. Federal Hall now has 7 writers, 3 of whom are Pulitzer Prize playwrights, and a dramaturge trying to devise a program that will animate the space for many hours during the day and provide much needed and inexpensive both rehearsal and performance space. So would be a fine example of adaptive reuse, and it is very much in the process now. A recent exhibit talked about what made New York, New York. I'm going to try to recall the 4 points that they made. The first one was finance. Money has always made New York go round. It was the early financial capital, and according to Wall Streeters, it still is. The second factor is its remarkable diversity. In some sections of Queens, neighborhoods, 138 languages are spoken, and people get along very well. So we have finance, diversity, then density. I think all of their research has proved that when people live in close proximity, they must work together, live together, and play together, and they figure out a way to do so. And the fourth aspect that has continued to have New York renew and revitalize itself is creativity. And New York must do everything it can to retain that creative base as most places become artists settle, the places become gentrified, artists exit, as do the original occupants. And if you've noticed, and I will talk in a moment about historic districts, that there is almost no neighborhood in New York City that is untouched now, in large part, because of the historic district designation and the self-help public-private partnerships that exist in those neighborhoods. Well, let's go back a while. Last night they were talking about the 250th anniversary of our republic. Well, I'm now at the midpoint telling you about New York's evolution. From 1860 to 1910, New York City saw the rise of unprecedented commercial prosperity. Very bold new styles and innovations emerged to meet the demands of commerce. This building is one of my favorites because the Harwood Building, a five-story palazzo-style cast iron building. If those of you are familiar with New York, it's on West Broadway and White Street. If you look at it and look above, you will see clearly that it's modeled on a 16th century Venetian library, but designed by John Gaynor and built by Daniel Badger of Architectural Ironworks. It's still in use today as a commercial loft building. It was originally a department store that sold cut glass, silverware, clocks, and chandeliers, with a notable patron, Mary Lincoln, who purchased custom-made china for the White House here. By the time the Harwood Building's construction was going on, Manhattan experienced three great fires in 1776, 1835, and 1845, and some of it related to, all of it related really, to construction of buildings that were not safeguarded. So the inventor James Bogardus attempted to find a fireproof building material and pioneered the use of cast iron because of its strength, its lightness, economy, durability, load-bearing potential, and most importantly, its fire resistance. So it was very popular in the 1800s. It still continues to be popular in various forms. But I like especially reading of the period. If those of you know, in the early end of the 19th, mid to mid 20th century, simplicity pattern books, you could order parts of things to sew patterns at home. Well, you could do the very same with cast iron. You selected the kind of facade you wanted, the kind of column, the kind of capital, and they would send you all the parts. And instead of the same kind of labor that put together the Sphinx or carved endlessly on stone buildings and expensively, you could have carpenters put this custom-made palazzo or building or office together in a very simple way, particularly since it replicated most of the classical orders. But there was something else when cast iron came, and I hope you're picturing the period. It made it possible for building facades to include more and larger windows, increasing interior light and the height of buildings. So in addition to its cast iron facade, the Harwood building was the first building to have what was referred to as an Otis, a hydraulically powered passenger elevator. So not only could you could build up, up, and up. And that is exactly what has happened to the vertical city of New York. This vertical hydraulic elevator had a safety device. So in this one building are included two very significant elements that provide the basis for today's skyscraper: the load-bearing metal frame and the vertical movement of passengers. Commercial growth in the city also led to an increased need for transportation and mobility. And here, an icon of New York's landscape, the Brooklyn Bridge, the first physical link between the then independent cities of Brooklyn and New York. The Brooklyn Bridge is one of the greatest feats of 19th century engineering. It was the world's longest steel wire suspension bridge from the time of its completion in 1883 until 1903, when the nearby Williamsburg Bridge opened that linked Brooklyn with Manhattan's Lower East Side. Construction of the Brooklyn Bridge took 16 years and claimed more than 20 lives, including that of its designer, engineer John Roebling, who died in 1869 as a result of an accident. So many of you may recall that his son Washington Roebling then took over as chief engineer, but by 1872, he suffered a crippling attack of what was referred to as the bends. Caissons were lowered beneath the water that were apparent to facilitate construction, but apparently were not sufficiently constructed soundly enough to create very serious physical problems with almost anyone who entered them, and certainly for repeated periods of times. He survived his attack of the bends, but his physical condition prevented him to return to the site. So here's an interesting tale, I think. So his wife, Emily Warren, acted as his intermediary. She learned complex mathematical equations and earned her credits as co-creator of the structure 134 years after its completion. He would be at the window with a telescope, and she would be at the site, and then would come back and report to him what he hoped and thought he saw. I'm sure many of you are aware of nowadays in building constructions, there are on-site cameras on every floor and every level. I prefer to think they're there to be certain that every floor is constructed properly and that maintenance of the site occurs. But you can see from whatever vantage points, you know, is the corresponding camera, exactly what goes on every part of the construction of a building. Well, it wasn't that way at all then. But the Brooklyn Bridge is an immediately recognizable symbol of New York, and I believe an aesthetic triumph with its elegant sweep of cables and its Gothic-inspired piers. They are symbolic portals to the two cities. By the way, these were all individual cities until 1898, when they were consolidated into one city called New York City, and the five boroughs, New York, Manhattan, sometimes referred to, Brooklyn, Queens, the Bronx, and Staten Island, comprise all of New York City. But they didn't exist as a consolidated force until 1898. By then, in the early 20th century, public buildings were also constructed on a very ambitious scale. In 1903 to 1913, Grand Central Terminal, built by Reed and Stem, Warren and Wetmore, combined the distinguished architecture with brilliant engineering. It accommodates under this one roof a vast network of merging railway lines and more than 750,000 people pass through daily. Grand Central represents the best of the French Beaux-Arts. It's very generously scaled and grandly conceived. Excuse me. If you see here the central vault of the central hall of Grand Central, a magnificent zodiac mural by Paul César Hellot, all completely restored and very beautiful, I think. In 1978, the United States Supreme Court upheld the city's right to declare Grand Central a landmark, ending plans to build a huge tower over the concourse. The High Court's decision also validated New York's landmarks law and the city's right to preserve its architectural and historical resources. When I mentioned there are 750,000 people that use Grand Central Terminal every day, I think I'll pause to mention the new subway lines in New York that just yesterday I read, New Yorkers like to call them a museum for the people that are underground, because leading artists, some yet to be discovered by a wider public, some mid-career, going all the way to Chuck Close in the new Second Avenue subway line. That took something like 100 years from the day it was first announced till the day it was opened on New Year's Day of this past year. But in this article, they compare some of the ceilings in the new subway to the most beautiful nearby subway that they know of, and it, of course, it is the Washington Subway, and called quite rightly one of the most beautiful public transit places there is. There is, however, one difference. There are a minimum of 6.5 million people who use the subway every day. There are 8.9 million people that are in residence in all of the five boroughs, but between tourists, peripheral states, and all the traffic, it is a staggering number to think that this subway system supports their comings and goings. By 1973, New York City's landmarks law was amended to afford protection to interior spaces and to city-owned scenic landmarks. So now there are 10 scenic landmarks. To give you an idea of their size, all of Central Park, its bushes, its pathways, its lumières, its statuary, whatever you can think of, in all of Central Park comprises one landmark. And that 843-acre marvel, at least most New Yorkers and visitors see it that way, I am among that number, to think of an 843-acre glowing green sward in the midst of a city larger than the entire Mediterranean Principality of Monaco exists right in the heart of the busiest heart of New York City. I want to go back to discuss that because the scenic landmarks have become a very important part of landmark designation in New York. They include places like Prospect Park and even one tree that you may have heard of that grew in Brooklyn, the Magnolia grandiflora, are a very significant part of the assets of the city. Each of the circuit routes in Central Park is visually and physically distinct from the others, where routes cross in a series of picturesque overpasses and underpasses, nearly each of them different from the other, permit continuous and separate pedestrian and automotive traffic flow. In this period spanning from 1910 to 1941, with the dawn of the new century, New York moved from the Gilded Age to the Machine Age, and skyscraper design evolved from the ornamental to the sleek. By far the most recognizable skyscraper of this era is the Empire State Building. And nowadays it doesn't let you forget, because you probably know that its crown is decorated in different colors to signify what is being celebrated on a particular day. And I'm happy to say, for whatever the series of complex reasons, they had orange, white, and blue, the colors of New York, for all of Preservation Week. That's why I believe in miracles. The Empire State Building was designed in 1930 by Shreve Lamon Harmon. It was built in only 11 months, and the Empire State Building was part of a great competition between the Chrysler Corporation's Walter Chrysler and General Motors CEO Joseph Raskov, who were in a fierce, keen contest to see who could build the tallest building in the world. I should tell you that the Chrysler Building, under cover of darkness one night, erected from the gargoyles and hubcaps ornamentation on the upper portion of it to the top, was installed again mechanically in just overnight, and of course by the next day had won the prize as the tallest building in the world. It had that title until 1973, when the former World Trade Center was built. For many, the Empire State Building and the Chrysler Building are still the two quintessential skyscrapers. Now, of course, the tower has computer lighting driven by high-speed computers and capable of displaying 16 million colors. One of the few projects completed in the years following the stock market crash of 1929, nearly 100 years later, is the still unmatched Rockefeller Center complex. It was designed and built from 1931 to 1939, and it is the greatest single civic gesture of 20th century New York architecture. In the first two decades of this century, nothing was built to equal it throughout the Depression. The construction of Rockefeller Center provided jobs for hundreds in the building industries. The complex, which originally extended just over three full city blocks in the heart of Manhattan, a main visual axis is the promenade and Channel Gardens that you can see on Fifth Avenue in the area of St. Patrick's Cathedral. The Channel Gardens slope gently downward and culminate in a sunken plaza adorned with a statue of Prometheus by Paul Manship. The architecture and the public spaces of Rockefeller Center are enhanced inside and out by artworks that are integral to the overall design. The statues of Atlas and Prometheus, the tympanum panel of wisdom, a sculptural relief entitled News by Isamu Noguchi, all these elements animate the exteriors of what might otherwise be thought as overly austere compositions. The unprecedented scope, visionary plan, and brilliant integration of art and architecture of Rockefeller Center are perhaps best understood when we realize that it has taken almost a century for New Yorkers to again contemplate construction of a project of this scale. The closest to date is going on right now, called Hudson Yards, downtown, another city within a city, with a proposed site of 17 million square feet of commercial and residential space on 28 acres of Manhattan's West Side, including at least the designs appear to be quite brilliant, is something referred to as the Shed, a performing arts space that has some apron that extends and recedes horizontally and vertically and is meant to be a multi-purpose space. The importance of spaces and places dedicated to leisure and entertainment during the Depression is epitomized by the world-famous 6,000-seat 1931 Radio City Music Hall, part of the Rockefeller Center complex, and I dare say many of you have been there on one occasion or another. It is a masterpiece of Art Deco design from 1933. But until 1979, the Music Hall was a first-run movie theater, and its ticket to the movie once included the renowned Rockettes stage show. In 1999, a $70 million renovation restored to the original the lavish interior created by industrial designer Donald Deske and the grand step proscenium arch. What I find so interesting, can you go back one, please? This is Radio City. And now I'd like you to look at, is it up? The next slide, please. This is the auditorium that Radio City is based on. It is the auditorium that is part of the New School for Social Research building in Greenwich Village, designed by Viennese architect and emigre of World War II, Joseph Urban, and completed after World War II. Completed by 1930, but the school was completed after World War II, with a faculty of many emigres, most distinguished emigres, largely, of course, from Europe at the time, that were the faculty of the school. But I think those two can give you an idea of inspiration. After World War II, the international style took root in New York City. A proliferation of glass and steel boxes marked the skyline. And it is ironic that these modern structures, now eligible themselves to become New York City landmarks, were once antithetical to the preservation movement, a movement that emerged to counter their construction in the 1950s and 60s, and to save the numerous historic buildings threatened and lost in their wake. The 1958 Seagram Building, designed by Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, Philip Johnson, and Conan Jacobs, is based on Mies' principle that less is more, a radical departure from earlier stone-clad skyscrapers with set back from the street on a slab-like plaza sheathed in bronze. Its transparent pink-gray glass floor-to-ceiling windows were made possible by interior modular partitions. Inside, Philip Johnson, responsible for the design of the Four Seasons restaurant, created the restaurant, once home to the so-called power lunch, has floor-to-ceiling draperies. Can you see those in the right-hand picture? They were installed as draperies, but little did they realize that the air coming from the heat and warm and cold air coming just below it would cause them to ripple, a completely unexpected but very desirable effect throughout the room. These draperies are made of anodized aluminum chains, and over the bar, you see Richard Lippold's delicate bronze sculpture. Incidentally, the Lippold is a designated landmark. And recently, when this restaurant was first built, it was built at the astronomical cost. Both the pool room, the bar room, and all of the ancillary rooms of $4.5 million, the costliest ever built when it opened in 1959. It was restored for its 50th anniversary in 2010. But the lease of the Four Seasons restaurant expired in July 2016, and a new restaurant, the owner of which to be run by a restaurant group together with the owner of the Four Seasons building, after railing about changing the landmark rooms, which they were not permitted to do. They were only permitted to change the furniture, but none of the architecture. And after months of consideration, they've decided to rename it the Landmark Rooms. That's after several years of fighting with the Landmarks Commission. The design of the Seagram Building and the nearby Lever House forever transformed Park Avenue from a boulevard of small masonry buildings to an imposing thoroughfare of large glass and steel office buildings, and with it, the corporate architecture of America. Some architects countered the minimalist trend with expressive form. Up Fifth Avenue, we'll see Frank Lloyd Wright's 1959 original masterpiece, the Solomon R. Guggenheim Museum, and interior. It breaks the street wall of Fifth Avenue and rises in ever-widening concrete bands, separated by ribbons of square-paned aluminum. That skylight is one of my favorite pictures. Inside the museum, the famous quarter-mile ramp, which you see, spirals upward, and natural light reaches the atrium from that beautiful glass skylight. Wright called the Guggenheim my pantheon. It is generally considered one of the finest pieces of outdoor sculpture in all of New York City. Other modernist landmarks include the 1956-62 TWA terminal at Kennedy Airport by Finnish-born architect Eero Saarinen. Distinctive, organic, and integrated with its surroundings, the terminal is Saarinen's spatial rendering of the sensation of flying. Through the use of sculpted soaring forms, the interior features a series of sinuous concrete shapes that form stairways, balconies, and vaulted ceilings. The distinctive head house, after being opened for tours in 2008, closed in 2016 to the public. It is, however, scheduled to reopen in 2018 as the 175,000 square foot lobby of a 505-room hotel complex. By the way, yesterday, February 28th, was the last day of the Waldorf Astoria's history as a hotel. It will now, the new owner has agreed to retain the lobby, all of those significant architectural features, the facade, but it will now be condominiums and I think some office space. But individual landmarks are only a part of the story of the increased designation and the increased importance of historic architecture during the last period. It is the rise of the significance of historic district during the last 15 years that has had an enormous impact on New York City. When I wrote the first edition of this publication in 1988, there were 50 historic districts and extensions, and it was considered the most massive preservation movement in any urban center, in any city, in any continent in the world. There are now 141 historic districts and extensions. These designations mean that over 35,000 properties now enjoy the protection of the Landmarks Preservation Commission. The abundance and variety of these buildings is surprising, ranging from the best efforts of our finest architects to excellent examples of vernacular architecture and vernacular building types. The Commission recently, like the country, has also shifted its perspective on the role of preservation. Its 2015 designation, for example, of the Stonewall Inn, one of the most important sites associated with LGBTQ history in the nation, focused largely on the event-filled history of the structure rather than on the architecture of this diminutive structure. The move to address social history as part of the designation process is a significant change and suggests that the multiple histories of New York City may be protected and preserved as they become more visible and significant to a wider public. The images you have seen today document and interpret some of the landmarks of New York, and I hope have enabled you to see with fresh eyes the growth of New York City from a rural colony to a small merchant city to the modern metropolis it is today. Brings into focus more than 50 years of growing awareness on the part of historians, preservationists, architects, appointed and elected officials, and most importantly, concerned citizens, that New York City is a city of stunning landmark resources. By preserving its landmarks, New York City has created an opportunity for us to step into a rich and diverse past, all without jeopardizing its vibrant future. A love of cities animates the desire to preserve what is beautiful, as well as the desire to remain open to what is new. It is the layering of different historic eras, each with its own set of values, that give cities their visual richness and dense meaning. New York City is, in part, a virtual time capsule of its past. Its buildings reflect layer upon layer of history and tradition, change and innovation. Now, I believe, it is our shared duty and obligation to preserve the landmarks of New York for the instruction, the use, and the delight of future generations. Thank you all for coming today.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.